Ready to pop the question? The jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds, and they're ready to ship to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to Histories of the Unexpected, the show in which we demonstrate that everything, simply everything, you can possibly think of has its own history, like slugs, bullies, and patronisation.
Oh, I love the idea of patronisation. Or we could do pain, gain, rain, the plane, the drain, and the insane. I'm channeling my inner Cypress Hill here. I'm thinking about insane in the membrane, insane in the brain. However, Sam, I had the most extraordinary experience the other day. I was lucky enough to go along to teach on an MA in public history module that's part of our fantastic heritage MA at the University of Plymouth. And I had an amazing class with this brilliant group of young historians and heritage professionals. And I was talking to them all about podcasting. And I got them at the end to brainstorm some ideas for Histories of the Unexpected. And they thought we should do trousers, underwear, ruffs, lockets. They thought we should also do statues. But my favourite was bananas. Oh. We've never done bananas. Bananas are about Banana Republic, Atlantic slave trade. Also, well, fascinatingly, it's the long-lost banana. Did you know that there was a long-lost banana?
No. Tell me about the long-lost banana.
Apparently, for like £1,000, you can buy the sort of long-lost bananas that's a taste that is no more. And we have the sort of modern-day bananas now. They don't really taste like bananas.
Oh, we do. We have bananas with no seeds in.
Mm.
Yeah. Okay.
So I think we should maybe do bananas. But that was courtesy of that brilliant class. I wish, in a way, that if I were doing my whole life again, I actually think I would take that heritage MA because they are just doing the most brilliant, fascinating work out everywhere. All sorts of properties, doing kind of real life, hands-on experience stuff. So, but also I think we should do the history of the thumb, because I've managed to sever my thumb this week with a very sharp Santuco blade, and took the top off it. And I was cooking, Sam Willis, a delightful Moroccan fish tagine, and there was a really large carrot that I was trying to slice, and just thinking, you know, Daybell thoughts, probably thinking about Histories of the Unexpected, and managed to just slice the top off. However, I think
thumbs would be fantastic.
Thumbs would really be good. Do. It's amazing how reliant on your thumb you are.
Because it's all to do with deep history and the power to control your hands, which is what makes us a unique species.
Yes.
And hitchhiking, obviously.
Yes. Yes. So we should.
Oh, and insults. There's a lot of biting of thumbs, isn't there?
Let's do thumbs next.
Right. Let's do thumbs and bananas, guys.
Thumbs and bananas.
Should probably crack on with what we're supposed to be talking
yes,
about.
Yes, exactly. Because we are monstrously digressing in a truly Daybellian way. Because we should, and we will, be following the links in our minds as we come across them, explaining how those histories link together in unexpected ways. Who knew, for example, this is one of my favourite recent episodes, who knew that the unexpected history of corridors is in fact all about humanitarian corridors. It's about Victorian hierarchy, French social planning, madness, crime, social control, and also the anti-Charybdis, yes, that is a word, world of the open space. It's also all about diplomacy and corridors of power, as well as war and new corridors. Who knew? Or who knew that the history of mothers is in fact all about Sigmund Freud's controversially proposed Oedipus complex. It's about the archaeological site of Banpo in China, discovered in 1953. It's about the Cross of Honour handed out to mothers in Nazi Germany. It's about Stalin's Order of Maternal Glory, And it's also all about the 15th century Paston letters and Lady Anne Clifford.
Two of my favourite episodes. They're absolutely fantastic, both of them. They sum up what it is to do histories of the unexpected. But now you're all probably wondering who is telling you all of this wonderful information. Let me just say that if history were an organ grinder, this is going to bend your brain. Yes, one of those remarkable historical characters who painted the world with sound without the need for any musical ability. Interesting fact there. Then this man would be his pet monkey, perching on history's shoulder with the bent hind legs of research, capering this way and that with his white gloves and pencils, performing intellectual tricks to draw attention to the past in the great fairground of the world. He is Professor Extraordinaire of Early Modern British History at Plymouth University. It's Professor James Daybell, the monkey.
Thank you very much. I'm not sure I like being a monkey in that analogy. Okay. I'd be the organ grinder rather than the monkey.
Okay.
If that's okay, I'd like to flip that. However, you're a monkey as well in this. You may well be wondering, who is that unattributed voice so ably helping Daybell co-pilot this very episode? Well, let's just say that if he were a monkey-related historian, he'd be swinging through the trees of the past, discovering the secrets that lie within the canopy, scrupulously picking through the flea-like facts of history in an attempt to make it hygienic and digestible for his readership. There's no monkeying around with this king of the historical swingers. It's the famous historical Dr. Sam Willis. Sorry, that's
very good.
It's very good. Sorry, I'm so amused by my own nonsense.
Yeah. Good. Hi guys, we're doing monkeys. And very excited about doing monkeys. I was reading an article in The Week, I think, which was inspired me. Was it me to do monkeys, or I found it afterwards? But fantastic. Do you know about the drunken monkey theory, James?
No, I don't.
So in 2014, a biologist, a chap called Robert Dudley from Berkeley, University of California, came up with an idea, and he suggests that humans may be congenitally drawn to alcohol because our ape and monkey ancestors learned millennia ago that if they followed the scent, it would lead them to particularly ripe fruit, which is what they wanted. And there's been all sorts of wonderful, fascinating research about this now, and discovered that actually, if you do a study like this and you study the fruit that the monkeys are eating and then the ones that they're discarding, they found that the alcohol concentration in the fruit they were eating is typically higher than the ones they were discarding. And the monkey's urine also reveals that the animals were metabolising the alcohol. So really interesting. So it shows that they were using it for energy. It wasn't just passing through their bodies. So they were specifically going for boozy fruit. So if you sit down and you have a nice gin and tonic at the end of the day, anyone who's listening here, then you need to nod towards your monkey ancestors, I think. I thought that was
nice.
A good story.
I had a similar sort of experimental sort of direction with this, and I was thinking about the infinite monkey theorem. I was out to dinner with colleagues on Friday night, and my wonderful colleague Rupert was telling me about this. The infinite monkey theorem, and this is the idea, you've probably heard about this, this is the idea that if you put a typewriter in front of a monkey, there is a probability that it will hit the keys at random, and if it does it for an infinite amount of time, it is almost surely able to type a work, like the complete works of Shakespeare. So, for example, Shakespeare's Hamlet, whatever. And there's all sorts of theorising being done about this from Borges and various other people. Some really complicated maths about it. It is highly, 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 highly unlikely, but not impossible. I started reading through all the sort of the mathematical theorems about it and frankly got lost in the first paragraph. It just suddenly, you know, defeated my GCSE A level or A grade level of maths, even though I'm, you know, tutoring my daughters as we go. But as I read further, I discovered actually that colleagues of mine in the art department at Plymouth many, many years ago had got some Arts Council funding to try this in practice. And so they got £2,000 from the Arts Council to try this with literal monkeys in Paignton Zoo in Devon, which is a wonderful zoo if you've never been there. And they had six monkeys in this enclosure, and they put a typewriter in it, and they left it there. And what they paid for really was the kit that enabled them to view this remotely. And actually, it was a piece of performance art. But their research from it basically said that it you know, very little came out of it. So it was a complete disaster. If you had a look at actually what happened, you know, one of the lead male monkeys started hitting it with a stone. They produced some material, which mainly consisted of one letter, the letter S, and a couple of other sort of letters that they typed in. And they ended up defecating on it. And so in a sense, they learned it was a total and utter disaster. But they learned an awful lot from it. And if you think about it in terms of what they learned about the monkeys, the director of the University's Institute for Digital Arts, Mike Phillips, described that what we learned from it was that monkeys are not random generators. They're more complex than that. They're quite interested in the screen, and they saw that when they typed a letter, something happened. There was a level of intention there. The scientific officer at Paignton Zoo, Dr. Amy Plowman, basically said that they learnt very little from it. You know, so there was very little sort of scientific stuff that flowed from it. But actually, as a piece of performance art, I think it's really quite important and quite meaningful. And it also showed that the infinite monkey theory was deeply flawed.
So, when was that recently? 10 years ago, did you say?
2002. So 20 years ago.
20 years ago. Yes. Good bit of history.
That's history itself.
Yeah, I love that. I looked into, after my analogy of you and being the organ grinder, the monkey on the organ grinder show, I looked into this, because I was suddenly really interested in these organs. I've got a vision of a guy standing there with a kind of, so it's a man, an elderly man is what I have a vision of, I might be wrong, with a box which has got a handle on it. You crank the handle and it produces music. So you don't, it's actually a really interesting musical device, which will have its own history, because you don't need skill to produce music. And it was actually developed in the 1700s in Europe, particularly in Italy. And because it produces music automatically, it's actually fascinating the way it's got a really important position in like the history of automation. So the early history of computers. It made me think of the... do you know what the Jacquard loom is? Think 19th century, early Industrial Revolution, and they start building machines that can weave cloth quicker. Right, the Jacquard one is the first one, so invented by a Frenchman, and he has a series of cards, right, which have got holes in them, and they control whether the weave or the weft or the waft, I'm not sure which one it is, but when it's raised up or when it's not raised up, which essentially determines the pattern on the loom. And this was all done manually, but he worked out a system of having these circular things, which basically allowed the material to pass through the hole, or it couldn't pass through the hole, and therefore by introducing these cards with punched holes in them, you could automatically control the manufacture of cloth in a certain way, and it could be done much faster, and it could be done without any skill. So you didn't have someone who actually had to kind of manually do it. And it made me think of exactly the same thing here, which was the this hand cranked organ. Anyway, this is all completely by the by, because the interesting about this, of course, is what's happening with the monkey. So it begins in Italy, brought to America by Italian immigrants, becomes very popular there. And then tends to go back to Europe, which is quite interesting. And everyone adopts the monkey as a little pet. It would kind of fly around, perform tricks, draw attention to the organ grinder, and collect money as well. Apart from in France, where they did it with little dogs rather than with monkeys. They became very popular. Because they became very popular, there are lots of accounts of them. They feature in lots of contemporary newspapers, particularly from the 19th century. A fantastic one here from the Washington Post in 1884 in October. It tells the story of an Italian organ grinder and his monkey dancing around in a red coat. And the story goes is that the organ grinder walks into the old deaf and dumb asylum on 6 and M Streets, not realising that the inhabitants would be unable to hear his music. Apparently, though, the residents really enjoyed the monkey's antics, and he left enriched by numerous coppers. It's a really interesting story, that, because actually what they're doing is they are laughing at the organ grinder. It's a kind of an example of fear of immigrants, racism, xenophobia. So, you know, it's a wonderful story of this stupid old organ grinder who took his organ into the deaf and dumb asylum. So, of course, no one could see him or hear him. So a silly place to go. And there are lots of other examples where tales of organ grinders are used to illustrate things like this. It's absolutely fascinating, but it's all to do with the relationship between immigrants and those who consider themselves non-immigrants, even though they probably immigrated to America in the first places. Also, examples of cruelty to the animals. Whenever you've got history with animals in, you always have some form of cruelty. There's always a history of cruelty, as we know with our episode on cats. If you haven't listened to our episode on cats, do go back and listen to that. It's one of the most interesting ones. So here, again, in the Washington Post, 1901, you've got a story of an 8-year-old called Thomas. And what he does is there's an organ grinder. Thomas, 8-year-old sort of naughty boy, starts climbing up a lamppost trying to chase this monkey away. Monkey gets to the top of the lamppost. Thomas pulls it down by the tail. Furious monkey spins round halfway, sinks teeth into hand of boy, and then starts chewing his fingers while this child is stuck up the lamppost. And then eventually is forced to let go by the organ grinder, who then has to defend his partner in court because it's attacked this boy, even though the boy has clearly antagonised it. And at the end of it, apparently, he goes off and plays a tune on his organ, which is "You'll Remember Me," which I thought was a wonderful way to end the story. So the history of Italian immigration and, you know, all of the kind of the problems that street musicians experienced in 19th century America. It was quite interesting also reading about it, the kind of people who were listening to the music. So it's street musicians, it's people who were kind of flocked around, were those who couldn't necessarily afford to go to music halls or, you know, buy early form of records, phonographs, whatever it might be. So certainly an entertainment for those who lived in the streets, for the poor. And it's very interesting the way that they reacted to the music and to the immigrants and to the pet monkeys, which they would have found exotic as well. Fascinating history there, James.
When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second-guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower-than-low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Oh, absolutely fascinating history, Sam. So I want to take it in a slightly different direction, and I want to talk about monkeys and the space race and the history of space flight. So monkeys going up into space. And I was reading several fascinating articles about this, about the different kinds of animals that went up into space, the difference between the American space program and the Russian space program, which I'll talk a little bit about. But we're talking here about post-World War II. So we're talking the sort of late 1940s when the space race is really taking off. And this is a time when scientists didn't really understand the impact that space travel, space flight, would have on the human body. So they worried that people would die, that cardiovascular systems would fail. They didn't know about the atmosphere in space. They thought that people would instantly die. And so what they turned to was large animals that sort of replicated humans and put them up into space. And of course, the kind of animal that they used first of all was the monkey. So they were looking for a primate that could approximate human beings. And one of the first examples of using a monkey was a rhesus monkey named Albert, who on the June 1948 was strapped into a V-2 rocket and went into what is called subspace. So it's below sort of deep space, and it's an altitude of about 39 miles or 63 kilometers. And they were really interested in what is happening to this. And of course, in this early stage, he dies basically, dies of suffocation. And in this sort of early phase, these monkeys are really being used in an experimental way and sacrifice their lives to what was basically the emerging of development of spaceflight. And we can see this sort of rolled over a number of years. In June 1949, another V-2 was launched. It went to an altitude of about 83 miles. And another rhesus monkey, this time Albert II, was put up there. And what happened here was he died. He survived the launch, but then there was a parachute failure, which meant that the capsule crashed into the ground with great force, and he died from that. There are similar Alberts. There is an Albert 3 and an Albert 4 and an Albert 5 and an Albert 6 between the years of late 1949 and 1951, all of whom died through one sort of happenstance or another, including another failed parachute failure. By about 1959, they have more or less sort of perfected things. And by this point, the United States has two primates that have gone up into space and they have survived afterwards. So a monkey named Abel, and also a squirrel monkey named Baker, of all things. And they managed to reach an altitude of around 300 miles aboard a rocket called Jupiter, and they were retrieved more or less unharmed, although Abel dies later on through an operation which was to remove an electrode that was underneath her skin. And so, but what this is basically enabling them to establish that it was safe to use humans to go up into space. And after that, you get monkeys still being used, monkeys and apes still being used, but they're there much more for experiments rather than to test whether flights actually work. So monkeys then are absolutely intrinsic to the scientific experiments of space exploration for the United States post-World War II up until about the end of the 1950s. The converse is true of the Soviet Union. They did not use monkeys, first of all. Instead, they used dogs. Did you know that, Sam?
Dogs. Rings a bell.
Dogs went into space. And one of the first dogs that went into space was a dog called Laker, which is translated as Barker. It's a very original name for a dog. And it orbited aboard the Sputnik 2 spacecraft in November 1957. And sadly, again, died during the flight. But instead of using monkeys in this early stage, they used canines. And it's only later on that in the 1980s and 1990s that they start using rhesus monkeys. We can also see this happening in France. So they send up in 1967, they send up some pigtailed macaque monkeys. And more recently in Iran, the Iranian space exploration in 2013, so in January 2013, launched a live monkey into space. So a space program that is slightly less well advanced than the Americans or the Russians. So there we are, Sam. That was what got me thinking historically about monkeys.
Very good. Fascinating stuff. I came across a brilliant story, which you'll see why I was interested in it. But it's about people finding some monkey teeth in Panama and why this is important. So about 4 million years ago, right, the tectonic plates that underlie North and South America smash into each other, and that creates the Isthmus of Panama. And this has been, you know, well known and established. But what's really interesting about it is that they've just found 7 monkey teeth in Panama. And it suggests that monkeys crossed from what was South America to North America before they were joined. And there was probably about 100 miles of ocean there before these two massive tectonic plates smashed in together. And the only explanation is that the monkeys somehow managed to get across that 100 miles. No small distance at all. Probably floated. They can't swim that far, so they floated over. And they probably did it on a kind of a mat of vegetation. You often get these when in that part of the world when there's been a hurricane or an earthquake or a tsunami, something like that, with things getting washed on shore. And so monkeys will hop on and will then basically navigate across from South America to North America. And I was fascinated by this. I thought it was a wonderful story of animals navigating or suddenly finding themselves in a different part of the world. But there's an even more stronger story here, because we know that the fossil record shows that monkeys evolved in Africa. And at some point in between 34 and 37 million years ago, they got to South America. So they actually did it. That's how they got to South America before they went to North America on a mat. They reckon they did it on a similar kind of mat of vegetation from Africa to South America. So I thought that was a fascinating deep history story there. But what I think is more interesting is that the monkey teeth were found in Panama because they were extending the Panama Canal. And I love the way that you've got this link between human engineering achievements and the growth in the knowledge of global history. And there are lots of other examples of it. I mean, the Panama Canal itself is fascinating. I bet this is, I need to look into this more, but I absolutely bet this is not the only kind of significant historical discovery that has come out of people excavating the Panama Canal. The canal itself, finished by the Americans 1904 to 1914. Really interesting early chapter. It was actually the French who began digging it in the late 19th century, because they, of course, owned all of the land around Panama. I was very surprised by that. I thought it was Spanish, but it wasn't. It was French. And it just so happened they had a very famous Frenchman, very good at building canals, a guy called Ferdinand de Lesseps, and he'd built the Suez Canal. This early attempt of the French to build the Suez Canal failed catastrophically because of the snakes, spiders, insects, yellow fever, the malaria, all at a time where they hadn't quite worked out that the mosquito was fundamental in transforming and moving diseases around populations. Really interesting history of how the French actually hid the number of deaths back in France
to make sure that they could carry on recruiting more people to come out and work on the project. But they were reckoning it was thousands and thousands of people died, maybe 22,000 in total, maybe 200 per month at the height of the construction of the Panama Canal. Now, these monkey teeth were discovered in a much more modern expansion project where they've essentially doubled the capacity of the Panama Canal. But that construction has its own history. And I love the way that there was a link between human construction, engineering efforts, and the discovering of history. It happens so much. I've done quite a lot of work of industrial archaeology and archaeology linked around modern construction projects. And the two very much go hand in hand, particularly now in China, where the Chinese are now legally required to excavate any archaeology that they discovered under as they go on developing their cities, which is why all of the most amazing discoveries are all happening in China primarily at the minute. So I thought it was a fascinating example to make us think of the link between human building projects and our understanding of history.
Oh, I love that, Sam. If you check your phone, I have just texted you an image that I'm going to talk about.
Ah.
So I was fascinated by the idea of monkeys in art. And so I wanted to do a little bit of reading about this. And I stumbled across a brilliant article by an art historian called Alexander Lee, who I think was at the time a fellow at Warwick University. And you can find it in History Today. And it's entitled From Wall Paintings in Egyptian Tombs to the Margins of Illuminated Manuscripts. And a history of monkeys. And basically, it's about Dutch art in the 16th through to the 17th century, when we get a total craze in monkeys. And the piece argues about a shift between sort of ancient and medieval approaches to monkeys, where basically you see monkeys cropping up all over the place, but they're seen very much in allegorical ways. They're seen very much in sort of moral terms. And then in the 16th century, they become figures of fun that are used to poke fun at human beings. And the article unpacks why that comes into being. And part of it is associated with the cabinets of curiosity that we find in the Netherlands at this period. And part of that is about displaying exoticism, exotic objects, and also really interesting pieces of art. And so we find that that pictures, paintings of monkeys become really topical and fascinating at this period. And it is also pioneered by several key artistic families throughout the late 16th and 17th centuries. People like the Van der Voorts, the Bruegels, the Frankens, the Teniers, and they have a real interest in this genre of painting. And that then leads to the development of this form of art, and lots of people sort of start painting in that form. The piece that I want you to look at, Sam, is a 1562 etching by one of the men in one of those sort of great artistic families, Peter van der Heyden. And it's a merchant robbed by monkeys. And this apparently turned the Dutch art world upside down. It follows a painting by Peter Bruegel, the elder, and it shows a well-known folk story. And if you have a look at this, it's in black and white, but if you have a look at it, we've got as a sort of rustic fellow with tousled hair who has fallen asleep. It's a peddler who's fallen asleep in a forest underneath a tree, and his peddler's pack he has left. A peddler's pack is a sort of, it's got a wooden lid. It's made out of what looks like woven material, woven sort of rope. And in it is all sorts of interesting articles that he would have taken to a local market and sold. And while he is asleep, a gang of monkeys has come out and started getting up to all kinds of mischief. And what's interesting about them is that they look really human in their appearance, and they are up to all sorts of tricks. They're running off with all his stuff. They're trying on. I see there a pair of gloves, which is fascinating for a book that I'm writing at the moment, just in case you had not noticed that I was writing a book on gloves. But they're trying on a pair of gloves. One of is trying on a pair of spectacles. Another is trying on a pair of children's sort of stockings. Another is going off with what looks like a scarf or ribbons. Another seems to be urinating into his hat. A couple are riding hobby horses. Others are sort of dancing around, playing on a drum. Another is actually pulling down his trousers and staring at his bare buttocks. So there's all sorts of mayhem that is going on here. And a lot of this, this sets off, as I said earlier on, this sets off a real craze for what is described as simian art, or these monkey games, and these monkeys being used, not in metaphorical or ornamental ways as they had been before, but in a sort of very, in the way of a parody, dressing them up in human clothes, doing human activities, getting involved in human affairs, and really ridiculing people. And we can see the influence that this has in a whole range of other paintings from the period. So Franz Franken the Younger painted a picture called Monkeys in the Kitchen. Jan Brueghel the Elder and Jan Brueghel the Younger both painted in this form. The Guardroom with Monkeys, David Tenier the Younger in 1633. So these are all sort of paintings that depict monkeys up to all sorts of mischief. Now, why does it become so popular? That's something else that he talks about in this. Part of it is as I said, it's about the cabinets of curiosities, it's about the families that promote it, but also I think some of it is due to the degree of foreign travel here, Dutch people's experience of monkeys. And as there is trade into North and West Africa and also into the Americas, what you have is the introduction to a bewildering range of different kinds of monkeys that they hadn't encountered before. You know, if you think about the macaques and the langurs, for example, monkeys that show a great deal of intelligence and really sort of human forms. These are brought back to Europe by sailors, by traders, by naturalists, and they suddenly become things that people are able to look at. There's also, however, at the same point, there's also a strand of thought and experimentation and thinking about the nature of monkeys. And I think this is really interesting. Before, they had been very much viewed through the lens of the Bible. God had created man very much in his image, and animals were lesser, imperfect forms of lives. And monkeys really are sort of in between because they are so similar to human beings. But then you have a strand of thought that starts seeing them as irrational beings. So they are, in some ways, they are seen very much as subhuman. And influential here is the philosopher René Descartes. And I think what this means is that we have a completely different way of looking at monkeys. And this ties in with what you were talking about, Sam, and the cruelty to monkeys that suddenly, and also ties in with what we were arguing about, what I was talking about with space and the way in which these monkeys were almost disposable. You could send them up for the, you know, great of scientific and space discovery. But basically, the argument was that they were irrational, didn't suffer pain, didn't experience emotion. So in a sense, they don't really deserve moral consideration, and then they can be mistreated, brutalised, and as the article says, even vivisected at will. And so I think that in itself is a really important sort of transition that happens in the 17th century and continues through into the 19th century, when I think you have, you know, you think about somebody like Charles Darwin. And Darwin is thinking much more about, you know, about the development of species. And actually, what we have is a sort of is a move back towards seeing the similarities of monkeys and humans as being much more important than those dissimilarities. So there we are, Sam. It's about the history of monkeys depicted in art, but then also about how we think about and conceptualise monkeys.
Yeah, fascinating stuff. And that has its own history, of course, as well. And unsurprisingly, you may think there's a lot of race theory, 19th century stuff going on there. And also some really interesting literature. People like Edgar Rice Burroughs, creator of Tarzan. And here, I mean, it's quite obvious what's going on here. But Tarzan, Mr. Burroughs tells us, actually means white skin in ape language, because Mr. Burroughs speaks ape language. And what you've got here is a story of a white man essentially ruling a black continent. It should inspire you to go back to the fairly extraordinary story of Tarzan and put it into a context of race relations and imperialism. Well, there we are, guys. That's our history of monkeys. What do you think of that, James?
Oh, I loved it, Sam.
So much more to do. I hope you've enjoyed it. Do please follow me on social media to find out what we've got coming up. I'm at Dr. Sam Willis. And also, if you're interested in maritime and naval history, do please check out my other podcast, the Mariner's Mirror podcast.
And you can follow me on social media on Twitter at James Daybell. You can follow the podcast at Unexpected Pod. You can also find us on Instagram and Facebook. So come along and make friends there. We also have a website. Oh, singing and dancing.
1993.
Website. historiesoftheunexpected.com, where you can find out everything that we've been doing. You can look at our back catalogue. You can get signed books, all those kinds of things. And also, should you wish to be a patron of Histories of the Unexpected, head over to patreon.com, where we have a page there and all sorts of interesting levels of membership to help us change the way in which people think about the past.
Absolutely. And we'll be back again soon, guys, with thumbs and bananas.
Excellent. Love it. Take care, guys. Bye.
Cheerio. Bye.